Working Cows Podcast, episode 225.
Welcome to the podcast that gives producers a platform to discuss and share paradigm-challenging practices. Practices that have increased the effectiveness of their operation and the joy that their families have received from this lifestyle.
Howdy, everybody. It's Clay Connery, host of the Working Cows Podcast, powered by the Global Ag Network. Very excited to be joined today by Bob Havard. Bob is recently been awarded a Nuffield scholarship, and he is, or a fellowship. He is going to be traveling around in the UK, and even maybe some in the States and in Canada, visiting people and talking about finding genetics that will perform on grass. And so we're going to talk to Bob about that. Had the opportunity to catch up with him. He's out traveling around, actually doing some of the interviews right now. And so very much appreciate him giving us some of his time to sit down and talk about this project that he is embarking on. Bob, thanks for joining me today on the Working Cows Podcast.
Thank you very much for having me, Clay. It's great to be here.
Last time we talked, I was sitting in a little coffee shop in North Dakota because I was rained out of the work I was supposed to be doing up there. And so I don't remember how we even got connected, but probably through social media. And we talked about just kind of some of the realities of what you guys were doing there on your operation in, is it the Midlands? Is that right?
Yeah, we're based in the Midlands of England.
Okay,
so about an hour south of Birmingham.
Okay, and so just quickly, kind of catch up people who maybe haven't heard that episode. It'll be linked in the show notes page for today, which is workingcows.net/225. Workingcows.net/225 will be the show notes page for today. Your previous episode, episode 98, will be linked there. But if you just catch us up a little bit on kind of your family's history there in England as it pertains to ranching.
Yeah, thanks, Clay. Yeah, so I mean, we've been on the home farm that we're on now. My great grandfather came there in 1919. He was a cattle drover and used to drive cattle down to the train stations, and then they'd take the cattle into Worcester and Hereford market from South Wales and the Welsh borders. The whole family's Welsh. And then, you know, after doing that for many years, the story goes, and apparently he was a it was quite good at telling stories, but the first train he took, he had a couple of the steers on there were his, and then the last train he took, pretty much the whole train were his cattle and bought the farm. Mm. So that's kind of how we ended up moving. You know, the family moved from Wales over to England, so grew up on a farm over here, which was about 185 acres, which back then was kind of sort of an average sized farm. You know, they've got bigger since then, I think. Dad and granddad were into pedigree sheep and pedigree cattle. They used to win quite a lot of show, Hereford cattle it was back then. And so bred a lot of those, came out of the pedigree scene in the 90s. And then I went off to college and trained and became an ecologist, and came back into the family business around about 2003, after Dad had some bad luck. We had the BSE scare over here and foot and mouth scare, and we didn't have either of those diseases, but the market moves at the wrong time for Dad. Mm. And then he was a contract shearer, so he used to shear sheep as well, and his back disintegrated. He made his spinal surgery, and then the bank made him sell. So we were down to 50 acres at home. I came back in 2003 and, you know, found lots of ways to not make money with ecological farming. I'm sorry if there's some dogs in the background. pushed on and found holistic management in about 2012, read Alan Savory's book, And then went on a Kurt Gadzia training course 2013. And that really changed everything. And we built the farm up to over 1,000 acres now. We'll have about 110 pedigree Angus cows to the bull in the summer. We also run 40 pedigree red poll cows on a contract farming agreement with another landowner on Breeden Hill, not too far away from us.
Sure.
And that's where we are. We're all grass-fed, regenerative. The ecology side, we try aim for maximum diversity wildflowers and produce good cattle off that diverse forage.
And I can't even remember if I've committed this cultural faux pas already in this episode, but last time I was maybe a little bit mocked in England for calling it a ranch when it's actually a farm. So I'll try to keep that straight.
Yeah, I got that too as well. I was claiming that I was a rancher. So, yeah.
All right. So, and you're using the term pedigree as registered, is that right?
That's right. So registered Angus.
Right.
Yeah, Aberdeen Angus.
Yep. And that just difference in culture. So I'm just trying to make sure I'm catching what you're laying down. And if I remember right from our conversation last time, you kind of led this transition towards holistic management, regenerative agriculture on the operation. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. So Dad had let me come in and we, when we did that holistic management course after I'd read Alan Tabor's book, Dad was quite skeptical. So I actually had to go and rent another farm and do it there. Mm. And you could see it worked. Yeah, he doesn't give a lot of praise, but I remember when I sold 60 fat steers and he looked the check we got, he knew there wasn't much cost in it. And he just put his hand on my shoulder and told me I better go and buy some more of them. And so that was good. You know, that's the highest praise that he's going to give. But yeah, it was. That's what made the difference. You know, we could see we could finish off grass if we managed it properly. What's great is the landowners and the whole environmental sector and farming sector over here seems to be massively moving towards this sort of management type, which is really positive, I think.
And is that just demand for grass-finished beef? Is that what's driving that move? Or is it the pressure of needing to produce a lower-cost product?
I think there's a real shift towards more ecological, agroecological farming, regenerative farming, whatever you want to call it. We seem to be at a massive policy crossroads in this country at the moment. So subsidies to farmers, which have been with us for a long time, are being phased out. Mm. So we've got to try and manage without. So that's your cost control you were just talking about. So we've got to look at that. But there's also a lot of pressure on the industry from the welfare side and the environmental side that people, you know, and the fake meat brigade are telling us we're evil and doing all the wrong things. So it's sort of, I think it's recognized in the industry that it's never been important that we show the good side of what we can do. And, you know, we can be stewards of the environment and we can improve the environment for us, for the animals, you know, and for everyone really.
Yeah. And I think early on, you mentioned that you've got an ecology degree. How has that influenced your view on these issues and how did that or did it prepare you for the switch when you came across Savory's work and some of those things?
Yeah, I've worked as an ecologist for various environmental charities over here and then ended up running a couple of charities, environmental charities, but I worked as a sort of jobbing ecologist consultant for a long time, doing a lot of plant surveys, and I was a grazing specialist. Mm. I think we touched on it last time a little bit, but there's within conservation over here, there's conservation grazing, where they tailor the grazing. It's not really tailored to production or profit at all, but purely for the benefit of whatever wildlife interest there is. And so I'd done a bit of that. So understanding the natural processes and the ecological processes that I was trying to create to improve these habitats, I think was a big advantage, is a big help. And the other thing is the identification knowledge. I was really lucky to work with some amazing botanists in my time. So just being able to identify the different plants at site was a big thing because you could see the change really quickly and you could also see the impact of the different species with their different physiology having a different impact on the soil and you know, the different plant types. So that was a big help for me, I think.
Sure. And we'll get to our topic eventually, but you keep giving me follow-up questions I need to ask. And that is, you mentioned that there's conservation grazing that doesn't really take into account profit, but just what is best for the wildlife at the site. And so would you say that it's possible to benefit wildlife and in so doing, hurt the rancher's pocketbook or hurt the rancher's bottom line? Sorry, farmer's bottom line. Would you say that that's possible, that you can take it too far in a sense?
I definitely you can.
Okay.
Because it's that you have to be considering all aspects, because if, you know, if someone's not making any money, or if they're, you know, the thing you'd find is on certain sites, they'd say, well, we want grazing for this month, and then we want them off, then we want back on for this month. And, you know, if that doesn't fit with timing of calving, weaning, finishing, whatever you've got in terms of your animal performance objectives, then that's not going to work. So, it definitely needed to be re-looked at. But what's good, it seems a lot of people in the conservation sector are waking up to holistic management and regenerative agriculture as a solution to provide the environmental outcomes they want to see. So I think that's really positive.
Sure. Very good. And to the topic now, and it's all connected really. I mean, you talked about the pedigree herds that you guys have going on there. You talked about the demand for, regenerative agriculture, conservation grazing, the demand for, you know, grass finished meat and those things. You are just now starting, if I understand right, the, process of embarking on a Neufeld scholarship, that the focus is, what are good or, helpful selection criteria for, finding animals that will finish on grass. Do I have that right?
Yeah, that's about it. I mean, I think one of the things I've found is, you know, you sort of, I'm sure all of us with the whole regenerative thing, you just end up going down rabbit hole after rabbit hole. And there's a lot of rabbit holes, you know, and especially on the selection of females or the selection for production off grass, whether it be linear measurement, whether it be the Jan Bonsma sort of skeletal selection stuff. Whether it's just purely on performance, the difference, you know, particularly the block data that people use for the EPDs, or we call them EBVs over here, but the performance recording, and just, you know, everyone's right when you speak to them, they all know the answers, but they can't all be right. And we've got our own experiences from, you know, 100 years of cattle on our place. It's trying to sort of, it's a great opportunity, the Nuffield Scholarship, for me to go and travel and study and visit people. I'm hoping to visit quite a few of the people who you've had on your podcast, to be honest, and talk to them about these different things and how they might fit together. And then the idea is we produce a 5,000 word report at the end of the study tour, which then is available online for anyone to see. And so, you know, I think we'd spoken before, but it'd be great once I finish the study if I come back and maybe talk about that to you in the future, if that's okay.
Absolutely. Look forward to that. Will this involve transatlantic travel then?
Yes, if they'll allow me in, but yeah. It's just the travel restrictions at the moment. I just hope all this, forgive me, but all this COVID nonsense stops before long. It's driving me mad.
Right. Well, just bring your wife along and then just stay. You can just stay in America. It'll be great.
Yeah, it was very tempting, I can tell you.
Not all of America, though. Like South Dakota, Oklahoma, Wyoming, they're open. But anyways, Eastern Oklahoma, I think, might be similar to what you're used to there in it might be a little hotter in the summer, but it might be used to as far as productivity is concerned. So anyways, back to it. What angle are you coming at it? Oh, let me clear up another piece of information. Is it BLUP data? Would that be like DNA or?
BLUP data would be more like the performance recorded EPD data.
Okay.
So it's the system really that backs that up.
Sure.
And then, of course, if we're talking about genetic stuff with the genomics, so, you know, and just to sort of answer your question and what angle I'm coming from, one of my concerns is that there's a lot of certainty given around a lot of these selection systems. And we know from experience of the of using the blood data on EPDs, EVs, that they can be really quite inconsistent, particularly when they're test those animals with those high numbered animals are tested within an environment that's limited. You know, we can all provide extra environment through additional feed, but if they don't have that, you know, and reality is our industry is moving into a situation where high input systems, I don't think are going to work for cattle, or it's certainly going to be harder. Then I think we need to make sure that these selection systems work for us. So I'm trying not to come at it from a particular angle, but I obviously have my biases. But I'm trying to keep an open mind so I can really look at this stuff, because I think the EBVs, if used right, if used correctly, could be fantastic. But, you know, there are many ways, I think, in which they're not, they could be used a lot better, put it that way.
Well, and I think that there's just so much information there that they can be made to say basically anything you want. I know people who think a lot like you and I think we think similarly along these lines. I know people who think a lot like you and I that appreciate the dollar EN or the dollar energy, EBV, EPD, whatever you want to call it. You know, they find value in that and they use that. They communicate it to it's Roger and Betsy Enderland. You know, they just had their sale here not too long ago, and they use that to communicate, you know, the performance of their herd to the guys that are going to be buying those genetics. But I mean, there's just so much data there that I feel like I said, you can make it say about anything you want, if you're willing to select certain numbers, in preference over others.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a huge amount of data. We know that, you know, if you're selecting for more than one trait, every additional trait you select for halves the speed of progress towards the group of traits that you're selecting. So having so much data on so many different things is going to basically mean we're not going to be making progress. And then if we look at some of the traits that are marketed as, so if we look at growth traits, we know that that's potentially antagonistic to fertility traits. And so if we're selecting in two directions, then we're just cancelling ourselves out and we're not really going anywhere. Those claims are not included in what's promoted in the marketing. So, I think it does need a lot of exploration on that, I think.
Sure. So I guess the direction I'd like to head, maybe since this is a preliminary episode and you're on the front end of this project, would be to just have you kind of lay out your hypothesis, if that is a good way to think about it, because it sounds to me like it is a project where you're going to start out with a certain set of expected outcomes or thoughts about what is true and go out and try to prove that with data and information collected from people in the field. Is that accurate to what you're doing?
I think so. I think it's, I really don't want to have a set idea about what I'm doing. I wouldn't necessarily say it's a hypothesis. I think it's, if there is a hypothesis, it's that there is that uncertainty about what we're doing. If we look at something like a weaning weight percentage or a weaning EBV, EPD, whatever, and then we think about what are we actually selecting for, you know, so we're selecting for increase in growth of a calf potentially as a proportion of its mother's weight, maybe. But why is it grown more? So is it grown more because it had growth hormones dominating or slightly, you know, bigger production of growth hormones? Is it heavier because it's grown more bone? Is it heavier because it's grown more meat, or, you know, what's the balance of, and if we're selecting for just weight gain, does that mean we're selecting against the how much fat it's going to deposit? Because, you know, it takes five times as many calories to deposit a kilo of fat than it does a kilo of muscle. So, and then if we're trying to have animals that sort of regain body condition and carry a bit of back fat into winter so they can get through winter carve and then breed again. We don't really want to be selecting against the deposition of fat and sort of messing with that. What else could we be selecting for? We could be selecting for rumen efficiency. But there are lots of management things that could interfere with that to give us an increase in rumen efficiency or feed efficiency, call it what you like. So this just like, that's what I mean by the uncertainty is actually we've got to be careful that by trying to be clever and think we're selecting on these numbers, that there's actually so many variables that are fitting into those numbers that I don't think we can be certain on the outcomes of what we're selecting. And if you think about, again, selecting on weight, you could have two animals that you select on weight that actually look very different. One could be, they could be exactly the same weight, but one could be quite leggy, you know. So coming back to actually your stockmanship and selecting on type and what they look like and bringing a bit of that with the visual assessment back, you know, to kind of test and keep honest some of the numbers, I think that's got to be a positive. So if I've got a bias, it's in that direction, really.
Hmm. Yeah, very good. Yeah, way back on episode 25, I think, of the Working Cows podcast, Kit Farrow said something along those lines, but he was talking about the amount of energy it takes to produce to build frame versus the amount of energy it takes to produce fat. And basically his argument was that if we can find those animals that stop growing frame earlier so that they can start putting on fat, that they are going to be the more fertile animals. Is that in line with your expectations?
I think so. Yeah. And absolutely. And I think we need that early sexual maturity, you know, and that the secondary sexual characteristics are only going to kick in once it's stopped growing. And so my understanding, and I think, you know, you've had folks on talking about Jan Bonsma and I think and Johan Zeitzman's good on this stuff is, you know, so there's a lot of great information out there, but, you know, essentially it seems that when, you know, when they reach the sexual maturity and those reproductive hormones dominate the growth hormones, and, you know, you see, you know, the growth plates and long bones close, and then you've got those secondary sexual characteristics coming and develop, and you need time enough for them to develop before the bull goes in order for them to be properly fertile. So, but how you assess for that, I mean, it might just be something as simple as, are they bulling at 12 months? You know, if you're going to put the bull in at 15 months, you know, are they, you know, so and just have a look at what's going on. That's going to tell you a fair bit if they're bulling hard.
Yeah. Yeah. Very good. You know, and I've been a member of Johan Zietzman's texting group on WhatsApp for a long time. And I mean, their holy grail cow is a heifer that can calve at 18 months. You know, so I mean, that's a bull that goes in 9 months, you know, wow. I mean, that's what they're looking for. Those really early sexually mature animals. So they're way down this rabbit hole. You mentioned rabbit holes earlier. I guess this is rabbit hole number 225. So, as far as I'm concerned, I think every episode's been a rabbit hole.
Be deep a rabbit hole for me, I think, 9 yeah. months.
Yeah. No, it's a neat field. I really, really, really appreciate. I really am excited to see what comes of your study. How are you hoping to conduct this study? I mean, if you're able to travel and go, where are some of the places you'd like to go? Who are some of the people you'd like to talk to? Some of those things.
We're actually in the middle of a planning process for that. So we've just been awarded it. And then we've had the initial Nuffield conference. Just to say, actually, while I'm on that is that anyone who's in a country that has Nuffield scholarships, I really highly recommend doing it. It's a fantastic network to join into. There's a lot of people in agriculture who really want to take the industry forward. And I think, you know, the more people on the regenerative side coming into this, the better, I think. But yeah, I've already this last week, I'm actually in Scotland. So I'm actually on one of the farms now. I'm visiting. So I've been visiting people all week, and looking at people doing regenerative systems. But it's also really interesting just going to a commercial farm that's trying to transition from great big cows, that perhaps might struggle in a completely outwintered system where the calves are kept on the cows a bit longer and might take a bit of condition off the cows. How are they going to transition? What are their main considerations? And, you know, just from a selfish point of view for me, this study is a fantastic opportunity for me to think about what my customers need and to learn about what my customers need by visiting people like that. But there's a chap I was at yesterday called Alex Bruder, who's doing some amazing things in the Scottish Highlands. So some really poor ground that actually with improved grazing is, you know, he's actually improving the quality of grass significantly that he's got up there. And one of the big concerns in this country is in the upland grazing in the hills and mountains up here. There's some really important and long-standing farming communities that without subsidies potentially are at risk. Yeah. Some of the work that he's doing to try and make these upland farms work and, you know, the type of cow he's going to need, you know, that I think it's fascinating and what an opportunity for him and others doing similar work to try and solve that puzzle, because it's so important for our family farms, I think. So yeah, I've got a few more visits in Scotland, but I soon realise I'm going to have to come back up here because there's a lot of people doing interesting things. I really want to come and see Craig Guffey, who you've had on the podcast, and he, if anyone's interested in the EPD debate, he's got your podcast with him. It was amazing. I love that. Very straight-talking guy. Aaron Nurbas as well. Mm. I've been working with, we're trying to import some of Aaron's genetics over here at the moment. So we're just getting some bulls of his tested. Aaron's a great guy and I'd love to go and visit him. So that'd be fascinating.
What draws you to Aaron's stuff? I mean, I will say I'm quite ignorant. I'm a typical ignorant American, but I'm pretty ignorant of weather patterns, other than that you told me you guys get a significant amount of rain throughout the year, and I don't think your winters are as cold. So Aaron's in a quite a bit harsher winter environment, I would guess, than where you are. And so what's attracting you to those genetics specifically?
We all sort of learn through imitation quite a lot, and I've definitely stolen some management stuff from Aaron in terms of, you know, using the bale pods that he does for slightly different reasons, but with a slightly different environment. But, you know, over there they've got this frozen solid ground, so it's fine to keep cattle out on that without any impact, and the, you know, the freeze thaw obviously perhaps helping some heave and bringing the soil compaction to the right place. So, but for us, the bale pods are really useful. Like if we get snow that's too thick for us to graze through, then we can bring them into a bale pod, you know, and it's usually not going to be more than a couple of weeks for us over here where we are. Up in the Highlands here, it could be a bit different. So I think the other thing with the environment is it's interesting. Like, I can't remember who I heard say, but like a cow's actually burning calories to cool down until it gets about minus 20. Hmm. So, but that's probably your dry cold that you get in your continental North America, which is a different kind of cold. So for us, you know, if it's 2 degrees with sideways rain in the middle of winter, that probably feels to the cow not far different to what the cows in the dry cold are facing. So it's different challenges, you know, to haven't got a dry bed to lie on, that takes a lot out of a cow as well. So what we like is the hardiness of that he's got bred into his cattle, but we also share some similar genetics. So we over here, we're very much focused on the native Angus. So we do mix it in with a bit of modern Angus for a bit of growth, but Aaron's used the native Angus over there. We've used similar bulls as well, actually. And actually one of the bulls that's been used widely in the States, Dunluise Gypsy Earl, I think he's the most exported bull of any breed in terms of semen to leave the UK. So that's a native Angus, which is a smaller framed animal, going back to the original old Angus cows. And you know, almost coming back to the topic a little bit there is that it's interesting, those older genetics, and people say, why do you want to go back in time? And then, you know, I was picking up this book on the history of the Angus breed a few, you know, probably 5 or 6 years ago. And you look at the first cow that was in the herd book was a cow called Old Granny. I don't know if you've heard about this one. But she was, I think she calved at two the first time. This was in 1867 or something. She calved at two, and then she had 27 calves on the trot. And, you know, every year consistently. So then I'm starting to think, you know, with all our cleverness and our numbers, you know, how far forward have we come since the first cow in the Angus herd book, you know? So I like those older genetics. And I think there's something in that the growth genetics, I think they've lost a bit of fertility. And I think Aaron's worked hard on that and done a great job there. So, you know, I'm interested in that. And we've seen it with that fertility in native cattle as well, because we had one of our foundation sires, Kaiser. He's 7 years old now, but he's bred really well for us. And his heifers last year were 100% in calf in a 60-day period, 90% were first cycle. And so we had him collected, and we took him down to UK Sire Services. It's the place that does the collections down in England and for international export. And they said, you know, usually with the Angus bulls, we're going to expect to get about 150 to 350 straws per jump. And they phoned me up after about 3 weeks and said, well, you know, this has happened before, but it's not common, but he's just done 1,100 straws in one jump. And then we did, see you laughing, but he did that three more times. And I think, you know, we know fertility is important. So, you know, that's why we like those genetics. And because Aaron's really tested them over there as well. So to bring something back, that'd be cool.
That's incredible. And I think earlier on, did you say 110 cows per bull?
We run about 110 cows. So that's how many cows we will put to a bulls next year.
Oh, so I see what you're saying. Okay. That's how many you will be exposed.
Breed. Yeah.
Gotcha. So, okay. I was going to say, man, back in the day, they were saying 50 cows to the bull. Now we're down to 25. Kind of, I think back to what you're saying about genetics, being, or the older bulls being maybe superior to the current ones, or at least what the industry is pushing our direction. And you know, so I was that caught my attention, and then you brought it back to my mind. But now I'm with you. 110 cows will be exposed at your farm this year.
That's right. Yeah. So, and we will run multiple bulls with them, so we just that there's a big competition there. And
yep.
But it'd be interesting with the native Angus, just coming back to that. Have you come across Geordie Souter from Dunluise Angus?
No.
So he's based near Forfar in Aberdeenshire. And he basically saved the native Angus. Mm. So that's the Angus that haven't had any introgression or any breeding lines come in from anywhere else in the world. So the pure Scottish Angus. He's a great guy. I would definitely get him on if you can, Clay, because he's a great speaker as well. So, and he's been over to the States a few times.
Very good. Yeah. I'll definitely look him up. That looks interesting. Sounds interesting. So yeah, I'm going to throw up some links in the show notes page. As you've been talking here, I've been Googling some stuff, and I see a little history here on Old Granny. 125 calved in 1824, was killed by lightning when past 35 years of age. She is reported to have had produced a total of 29 calves, 11 of which were registered in the herd book. So it's incredible. Just those genetics were amazing. What do you think are some of the issues or decisions or things that we've pursued that have led these current the current Angus genetics to not be as fertile as previous ones? Is it kind of an inverse relationship between fertility and productivity as far as individuals are concerned, and their ability to wean a big calf is going to affect their ability to breed consistently. Do you is that right in your mind?
Yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head when you said individual. So we, you know, you go and buy a catalog, a breeding catalog or whatever, and you've just got lots of pictures of bulls. It's all about the individual. So first of all, it's all about the bull instead of being about the cow. And we need to perhaps push the female side of it up a bit more. But it's also all about the individual. It's about the outlier. It's about the special animal. And really what we need is the consistent performer of that within the whole performance within the whole herd. And I think that's just led us down a few paths. I mean, I will say that I think there is a place for the terminal genetics within Aberdeen Angus. So I don't want it to sound like I'm sort of crapping on Angus at all, really, because I think the problem is that a lot of the terminal line Angus, which are very good terminal lines, and that, you know, for a terminal line, they're very easy carving. They're an ideal bull to use on a maternal line. And so those terminal guys, I think, should just concentrate. I mean, it's not for me to tell them what to do, but, you know, I think, you know, I tell our bull customers to use terminal bulls on the cows they're not using for replacements. And they use our bulls for replacements for the maternal lines. And then that terminal genetics just gets them some free growth that, you know, the maternal lines probably won't bring. But that balance of individual performance and herd performance, and I think, is important. And if we go back in time over here, it was always a thing that you'd have hybrid vigor in your cow, and then you'd use a terminal sire, and you'd have a really strong maternal line or two strong maternal lines in the cow, and then the terminal sire on top. So the commercial producers got the benefit of hybrid vigor, but also got that inherent fertility that comes from seed stock producers who are providing that instead of providing heterosis, which seems to happen when they chase the numbers a bit too much.
Sure. Yeah. So if you'll forgive my American lexicon, just because two critters are the same color doesn't mean that you have a maternal pairing.
Yeah, exactly. 100%.
So, and I think that was something that I picked up early on too, that, a lot of the bulls, even Angus bulls being sold in I'm sure England and America today, are really terminal sires. They are bred to perform in a feedlot. They're produced to perform in a feedlot and in a finishing situation, whatever that is. But it's got to be a high mega cal ration finish, you know, finishing situation. So they are, if that's what they are, then that's what they are. And we should treat them as such. But if we're going to try and find animals that can produce on grass, it's probably going to be a little bit different animal. And we just got to know what we're trying to do and follow that, make sure we're aware of what we're trying to do.
Absolutely. 100%. And that's it. If we could do it off grass, then by definition, the amount of environment that's available is limited. So it's got to be able to do it within its environment. And I had an interesting chat with one of the farms I visited here the other day, and they started managing their grazing and increased the quality of their grass. And so they were then thinking, you know, well, now I can increase the size of my individual animals within the herd. So I'm getting more growth, more production that way. And we were just having a conversation around, well, hang on, is it what happens, you know, if we get a bad year, we get a bad weather year, and we don't get this benefit of the increased environment, then suddenly we've got an animal that is less adapted. So rather than maybe increase the productivity of the individual animal, if we improve in our grass, maybe we just increase the number of animals, you know, and we can put a bit of pressure on that way. And then if, you know, if things do change environmentally, then at least we can just cut numbers rather than, you know, suddenly find we've got something that's not suited to our where we are. And I think that happened a little bit. And it's something that changes slowly. So it's something perhaps you wouldn't see straight away, but could end up costing you some money.
Mm. Yeah. What do you think? Do you think then that the role of the seed stock producer, I guess is the, I'm trying to figure out how to phrase this question. There's two different paths we can go down, terminal and maternal. And how do we go about choosing the path? I mean, how is it just what we enjoy, what we want to do? Is there some environmental or resource things that should help us make that decision? I mean, how do we go about choosing what direction we want to go?
Yeah, well, I think part of it is, you know, I believe that we ought to all live in a free society where we choose our own path for a starter. And so it's not for me to tell anyone else how they should run their operation. But, you know, if we look in the UK, we're really lacking in the maternal side in terms of the performance of our national herd. And I think that's because the terminal lines have been sold, marketed to say that they are maternal when they're not. But I do think there needs to be, in my opinion, there needs to be differentiation between the two. If you look at really intensive industries, like even if you look at like chicken production, broiler chickens, they have maternal lines specifically for the maternal jobs. And then they have the terminal lines specifically for the, you know, they don't, you know, and you can look at maize growing, you know, how they use the actual corn people grow is actually the hybrid of two things that don't look pretty very productive, but the hybrid produces those two seed stocks of corn. They when they're crossed together, they produce above themselves. And I think something that's happened, you know, a fair bit of people chasing these high numbers is that they realize that growth rate and performance can be, you know, you get hybrid vigor. So with more heterosis, you get more hybrid vigor. So you go and find a high growth bull from Australia, then you'll get a high growth bull from Canada, then one from America. Keep bringing those in, increase the heterosis, the growth numbers go up. But then you're not passing on the benefit of heterosis to the actual commercial operator. So, you know, if you've got a line bred bull or a close bred bull, then the outcross is actually you're going to get a bigger jump in performance from the vigor. And I think that's what, as a seed, that's an opportunity for me as a seed stock producer to provide that benefit by having close bred bulls that have got inherent fertility. You know, that's what we're aiming for.
Yeah. I'm trying to be conscious of the use of American colloquialisms, but I will say that if you are using terminal cows or cows that should be terminal, you know, and you're keeping heifers out of those heifers are just going to accentuate the problem. And here comes the colloquialism. They're going to eat you out of house and home. You know, they just, need more production than a maternal cow does to produce the same results.
Yeah, absolutely. They're almost by definition, they're bred to have a higher energy requirement so they can grow more. And so that's it. And it's not just that, though. I think that often the high growth has an impact on structure. So you notice that the really high growth animals often will be post-legged on the hind legs. You're getting those long bones are longer, and that has an impact on structure and therefore their resilience. So there's cost comes in there. The big, you know, high ribeye area, which people are selecting for, well, that's correlated with calving difficulty. You know, and then, so I just think, and then what do you call terminal? Because you could then look at maybe marbling. Is that part of the terminal picture in order to get a higher grade when you're selling the meat or to get a premium? But then should we have that marbling anywhere near the maternal line or just leave that in the terminal bit? Because, you know, a high marbled bull it means that there's something going on with the hormone balance. Because if a bull's high in testosterone, it's going to be higher in lean meat. So if we start selecting for more marbling, we're probably selecting away from fertility, or certainly away from the hormone balance that brings you fertility. So everything for me, holistic management's been the thing that's helped our business more than anything. And the thing within that is almost like you've got to be humble enough to think you're always wrong. And everything's got unintended consequences. So you select for this, what's the consequence? But so if we can keep it simple and select the maternal side, you know, that's what we try and do. then at least hopefully you've got a clear objective, and then someone else can provide a good terminal cattle, and there's lots of good terminal cattle.
So you're on this journey with the Nuffield Scholarship, and you are finding these producers who are seeking to find more grass efficient females, I guess, or grass efficient cattle in general. Do you anticipate any pushback? Do you anticipate anybody questioning, you know, what you come up with? What do you anticipate those questions being? How are you thinking about some of those things?
Yeah, I certainly hope there is pushback, because, you know, those are the best conversations, aren't they? And I went to see on Tuesday a guy called Duncan Morrison in Aberdeenshire. And he's a fairly young guy. I think he's 31. He's built his operation up to about 200 cows. He's actually on the council of the Aberdeen Angus Society in the UK. And he does do a lot of performance recording. But I think it's interesting, because it's rather than focus on the individual performance, he's very much looking at herd performance. And I think that's where it can be really useful. And it was good to link up, because another thing that Duncan's doing is he's really pushing. We haven't had this pathfinder system that you've had in the States, in this country. And so he's looking at going through the entire herd book and looking at which cows have consistently had a calf from 2 years old every year, problem free. And then, you know, provide that database of the pathfinder cows. I think it might be called they're going to call it the maternal efficiency list or something, but I'm not sure if it's got a proper name yet. But I just think that's brilliant, because whatever the breeders are doing, that's going to that's going to test me. That'll test everyone, because, you know, you can all see whether your cow's breeding regularly from what's on that list. So it's just something as simple as that can make a huge difference, I think. And he's definitely using the numbers. So, so I think it's good just to bounce things around and see, and positive developments like that maybe come from it.
So there isn't like a World Angus Association necessarily, I'm guessing. I don't know. There might be that I'm unaware of. But is there alignment between like the American Angus Association and the Aberdeen Angus Association, or is the Aberdeen Angus Association more in line with that maternal cow, and then the American Angus Association has been, at least for what it seems the last number of years, pursuing these more terminal lines. Is that accurate?
Yeah. I think they're all their own entities really, but right. There is good crossover, and I think there is good join up. Every breed society, I think, has, you know, I'm not a great committee person, but there are committees that decide things, and things get taken in each direction, and for good or bad or whatever. But, you know, it's a very long standing society in the UK. There is something called the World Angus Forum, which travels around the world, and there's like a big conference and tours around different herds. And that happens, so that goes around the world. So people join up, the different societies join up that way. And Angus breeders obviously are sharing genetics internationally. And it's a good point you make, because I think, like I was saying with Aaron, and we brought some of Craig Guffey's embryos in earlier this year. So we're going to have some Swearengen Angus genetics here at Phepson this year, hopefully. But that's the great thing, actually, that, you know, programs like yours and the internet allow us to link up with all these breeders across the world who have similar objectives. So there is really cool alignment there. And I think, and it's just great being able to talk to people interested in the same things, isn't it? And, you know, we'll talk about this forever if you let us.
Yeah, no doubt. Well, as an illustration of that, I think I told you before we started that my first question was going to be along these lines of going to Steve Campbell's class and getting my ideas of what it means to find a good looking cow or a cow that'll perform, getting that all dumped out and having new information dumped back into my head. And Steve's been influenced by Johan Zietzman and Jan Bonsma and Gerald Fry and Dick Diven and all these guys. And we never really got around to that question. question, but I will say this: after going to that class, you know, what drew me back to you? Just what drew me back to you was your cover photo on Facebook. Those two bulls kind of just fit that that phenotype really well, and it was, I wouldn't have noticed that if it hadn't been for you know, getting outside the box and getting exposed to a different way of looking at cattle. So I've just really appreciated that, and now I understand a lot better, not fully, but a lot better, kind of where you're coming from, better than I did when I first talked to you way back on episode 98, for sure. So
thanks. Yeah, it's those bulls. I mean, I can't take the credit for breeding either of them, so but yeah, they're ones we brought in. One's was bred by Geordie Souter, who I mentioned earlier, and then Kaiser, who's the bull we had collected, he was bred by a guy called Andy Humphreys, who's no longer with us. And Andy bred the native Angus all his life, and because they can be, they used to get called the belt buckle cattle, they can be a little bit small. But he'd always bred them to be a bit bigger. And he particularly liked the lines of a bull from the 1960s called Evesund of Duplin, who had an amazing nickname. He was called the Great Fixer of Udders. and we all wish we could have a nickname like that. Yeah, and so, you know, again, it comes back to the... There's interesting things, like you say, with Steve Campbell and the correct udders often being a sign of good fertility.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, it's interesting that you've got a bull that's proven himself fertile, but he's also a good udder bull, you know, he's fixing it in the same way. And that's the interesting thing that I find, is these things all start lining up.
Yeah.
And you were saying earlier before when we were chatting that, you know, how that then relates to the environment as well, and all of these things sort of fit in, don't they?
Yeah. And again, I meant to give a shout out at the beginning of this episode to Brian Alexander, who had Ben Gottschall on his podcast, Ranching Reboot. And I think it was tongue in cheek. I never asked Ben about it, but I think it was tongue in cheek when he was talking about, like, and actually I think it was in relation to this idea that bald udders indicate higher butter fat and some of those things, like an udder with fine hair or no hair on it is an indication of higher butter fat, which correlates to fertility and some of those things. And he said, all I have is 12 years of my own anecdotal data to suggest that this is true. So.
Yeah, it's good. But those are the best conversations, aren't they?
Yeah.
That's worth a lot.
So yeah. Very good. You know, we could go on for a long time, but I think you're getting close to, and I don't know what it's called there, supper, dinner. You're getting close to a mealtime, I'm guessing, but I really appreciate you taking the time to join me. Is there any way we could direct people to keep up with what you're doing with the Nuffield Scholarship and some of those things?
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, Clay. We talked about this a bit earlier, but the what would be good, have a look on Twitter. So I'm Phepson Angus on Twitter. I think it's at Rob Havard 1. So I'll post a few updates, some of the visit stuff I've already put up there. On Facebook, we're at Phepson Angus for the cattle. And what I hope to do is, as I go visiting around, is then... I hope to perhaps get some of your advice on this if I can, Clay, but I'd like to do a podcast with a lot of people I visit, and so that I've got a bit of a record of the conversations I've had and then share that with people. So if I could be cheeky and ask a favor to a bit promotional on that when we get that going, that'd be great.
Yeah, absolutely. Definitely. Yeah. And I would love to help you find some equipment and stuff that'll make it easy to do it on the go and some of those things. So we'll talk about that a little bit more offline. I appreciate you taking the time to join me today.
Thank you very much, Clay. Really appreciate it. Thanks for the invite.
As always, very good stuff. Whenever you get a chance to talk to Bob Havard, look forward to the development of this project and hopefully the development of that podcast. Really, really looking forward to that, and would love to get him back on when he starts that. And if you ever want to start a podcast, I'd be happy to help you start that. I've helped a few people start them, and also would be happy to help you launch it by having you on the show and talking about it. So very much really enjoy seeing people dive in, folks like Jason Meadows and Mary Jo Ehrman and others, Jared Lumen and
Brian Alexander and all those guys that have really jumped off, guys and gal that have really jumped off into it and stuck with it for a long period of time and been producing some great content, been very good to get other perspectives. You know, there's no worry about interviewing other people, you know, or the same people, because we have all have different experiences and perspectives. That means that our content is going to be different. So if you want to check those ones out that I mentioned, Ag State of Mind, Farming Without the Bank, Ranching Reboot, Herd Quitter Podcast, all very much worth checking out, all doing a great job of consistently dropping great content. Do want to say a special shout out to the Patreon supporters and also those who have sent me stuff off the Amazon wish list. The Amazon wish list is up to date. I've just pretty much gotten everything I could ever ask for. I would just be greedy at this point to ask for more. There's just a couple of things left on there that would be nice to have, but been great. And I was able to capture a lot of great bonus content for the Patreon supporters at the Farm and Ranch Conference that you can find at patreon.com/workingcows. Some of you that started supporting at the early $5 level, you can find that on a password protected page at workingcows.net/Patreon. So, not to confuse you, but patreon.com/workingcows is where, new bonus content goes at the $10 a month level, and other stuff ends up on a password protected site for, people who started supporting at the $5 level early on. So very much appreciate you guys. Look forward to releasing that bonus content, and looking forward to next week. We're going to be talking to Sage Askin about using Peruvian herders. So stick around and we'll see you very soon with another episode of the Working Cows Podcast.
We invite you to visit workingcows.net to subscribe to the show via iTunes or Stitcher. You'll also find detailed show notes pages, resources from our guests, and the industry leaders who have influenced them. For more ideas on putting your cows to work for you in a more profitable way, tune in next week.